Accession number 10759, Reel 3.
In room 3, you were telling me about how disfigurement affected your morale at first.
Well, it wasn't necessarily my morale, but anybody that had been disfigured. I mean, you could imagine the reactions of young aircrew, for instance, who had been badly burned, who got into East Grinstead. I think it was one of the biggest battles that Mackinder had to combat. You know, you probably have a lad of about 20 or 21 in a fairly glamorous aircrew occupation. Not finding it difficult to attract the girls, and then suddenly, within a matter of a minute, he probably finds himself looking like a monster. Mackinder approached this extremely well, and I think it is to his credit that he didn't have a single suicide amongst his guinea pigs, which I think was quite remarkable. One of the ways he approached it was that he approached the whole population of East Grinstead and explained the problem to them, and so the whole of the population of Greece, East Grinstead, I suppose, in those days cooperated, and they accepted the guinea pigs as perfectly normal human beings. So if you went to a dance, for instance, the girls might come up and ask you for a dance, and I think this worked wonders, you know. The other great thing he did was he wouldn't have hospital blues in the hospital. Everybody wore their uniform, and I think that was a great morale booster too. In fact, the only time he'd use hospital blues, if he overstepped the mark and made a fool of himself, he might slap you into hospital blues for a week as just to remind you. And, that very quickly brought you back to sanity.
Was there much comradeship between the people in the hospital at East Grinstead?
Oh yes, it was a tremendous place. Tremendous place. I think they did a marvellous job there. One only had to look at the success rate in life after leaving East Grinstead, the success rate amongst the guinea pigs, I mean, to see how well it worked, you know. These chaps qualified in all sorts of ways. Colin Hodgkinson, for instance, who lost both legs, one off below the knee and the other above the knee, ended up as a leading Fleet Street journalist. So did Bill Simpson. Several guinea pigs qualified as doctors, engineers, accountants. Quite a few of them, God forbid, ended up as head teachers. You know, the success rate amongst guinea pigs was very high.
That included yourself, of course, as a head teacher.
Yeah, well, I wasn't burned. although I might have felt sorry for myself when I was at Ely, by the time I got there to East Grinstead, I can assure you I didn't, because there were so many people there who were very much more injured than I was, you know. Tom Glebe was a case in point. Tom was very badly burned. And Tom ended up as a great success. He ended up as a senior rank in the RAF as a group captain.
Did you have anything to do with the formation of the Guinea Pig Club?
No, the Guinea Pig Club was formed before I joined it. It was actually originally formed during the Battle of Britain. How it was formed, actually, was quite interesting. It was there were a group of them in Ward 3, which is a wooden hut in the hospital, and they decided to revive their spirits to have a party. So they went round to the surgeon's mess with a couple of bottles of sherry, and while they were there knocking the sherry back, there was an air gunner who had been in and out of the operating theatre about 5 times by this time, you know, having various graps. And apparently he was overheard to mention that he was due in for an operation the following day. And he said anybody would think we were a load of bloody guinea pigs, hence the term, and that's how it started. So by the time I got to East Grinstead, it was well and truly underway, you know.
But you were enrolled as a member?
Yes, anybody that had plastic surgery done at East Grinstead was automatically enrolled as a member.
You gave a brief description of Archibald Mackinder,
yes,
when you first saw him, so
yes,
he didn't really look like a surgeon.
No, not at all, and he didn't act like one. His manner was completely outgoing. He was a complete optimist. tremendous personality, and always hopeful of success. And he was able to instill this into his patients, you see, I think, which was a tremendous advantage. And he also, he'd handpicked his team. He had a very good team. They'd obviously been handpicked for the job. I mean, there was an assistant surgeon there. I think his name was Jerry Hall. His anaesthetist was a fellow called Hunter, and the assistant anaesthetist, who incidentally was an old school friend of mine, I'd lost touch with him, but we had been in the sixth form together, and while they were, they'd got me on the trolley ready to move me into theatre, and this bloke arrived in a surgical mask, ready to put the hypodermic needle in, and because we recognised each other. I hadn't seen each other then for about, well, it must have been 10 years, I suppose, because he did his medical training in London, you see. And they were all these types of people. They were able to instill this feeling into their patients. Because remember, a lot of these chaps underwent years of surgery. I mean, they were guinea pigs still receiving plastic surgery in the early 50s. So it was quite an achievement to keep that morale going the whole time.
You said that McIndoe was outgoing because we think of senior medical personnel as people who are rather cagey and unwilling to...
No, he was the exact opposite. And he would tell you exactly what the operation was going to entail, what he was going to do. And he would even invite guinea pigs in to see operations on other guinea pigs.
Did you do that?
Yes, I saw one. I saw a friend of mine having his eyelids done. He'd been badly burned. As you probably know, if the loss of eyelids is quite serious, if it's not done as an emergency operation, you can go blind. And it was quite remarkable. He took the skin from the pit of his stomach, used the pubic hairs as eyelashes, and he had the stitches out and the eyelids working within about 7 days. As far as I know, this chap's still using them. A lot of the operations he did, in fact, for those days, I think, were quite miraculous. And of course, there was all this experimentation was going on the whole time. It was, hence the term guinea pig. I mean, at the start of plastic surgery, I don't think it was even recognised by the General Medical Council, you know. So it was very much an experimental stage.
Did seeing that operation help you? Because some people might feel a bit squeamish about it.
No, I think it did. I didn't feel squeamish about it. I mean, by this time, I'd seen so many gruesome sights in the hospital that... that was minor by comparison, you know.
Gruesome sights in the way of treatment, or
the arrival of burn cases. Mm.
We haven't said anything about Don Bennett, because I think that you actually met him.
Yes, I only met him in a formal sense during the war. I mean, he was, as you know, he was an Air Vice Marshal. I was a flying officer at that stage, later a flight lieutenant. But... he came to one of our briefings, I think it was the Essen trip, and he sat in when we were being interviewed by the intelligence officer, and one couldn't help but feeling very impressed by his complete knowledge of the situation and his grasp of it, you know, and he obviously knew what he was talking about and knew the situation as it would arise over the target and the difficulties that one would encounter. And I'm quite sure if he'd taken over from the intelligence officer, he probably would have done an equally as good job, if not better. The next time I met him was at a mess party. He came to a mess party on 156 Squadron, and he seemed to be completely lacking in starch, if you know what I mean. He was completely able to integrate into the squadron society. And even though he was at that stage a very senior rank, I mean, he was hobnobbing with crew members and chatting to them about their experiences and what have you. And as I said, I think he was the man for the job. Perhaps the war experience throws up people like this, but it certainly did in the case of Don Bennett. I suppose one could speculate what would have happened to the RAF if he'd decided to sign on and continue his career in the RAF, but I think possibly he was the type of personality, the type of character that probably couldn't have accommodated peacetime soldiering, you know. I just don't think it was on. That's why he became an industrialist. Well, of course, he ran his own civil airline for a time, didn't he? South American Airlines. And then I believe he was on the board of Bond Minicars. I'm not quite sure what he ended up as, I don't know, but...
You're saying that he lacked starch, but the fear always of people in authority is that if you become informal, that the people that you exercise the authority over will take advantage of it.
I don't think that ever arose in aircrew. It wasn't that sort of organisation. You mentioned, for instance, that PFF regarded themselves as an elite force. Well, they were an elite force, let's face it. I mean, they were a grammar school intake, weren't they? The vast majority of aircrew had been grammar school trained. They were intelligent people. They had a complete dedication to the job they were doing. And, I mean, quite often rank didn't enter into it. I mean, for instance, in our crew, we had three officers and four NCOs, but we were on Christian name terms. I think one had to be in that sort of situation. And to a certain extent, I think Don Bennett also had this approach to his squadrons. I mean, obviously, one respected him with great respect because he knew his job and because he held a senior rank. But nevertheless, you could talk to him, which is more than you could do with other people of equivalent rank or even lower rank, you know.
So the educational background of aircrew was typically grammar school rather than,
mostly,
say, public school?
Oh, yes. I met very few public school members. I met a few, but very few. I think it was essentially grammar school.
What was your own educational
background? I was grammar school. I was at Newport High School. Well, I'd like to sum up by saying that I think it was a rare privilege to have served in Bomber Command, an experience that one could never repeat, and possibly far more valuable than a university experience. I had experiences both in training and operational flying that I would never have had in the ordinary way, and met people, the most interesting people that I would never have met in the ordinary way. And I suppose to a certain extent, practically everything that's happened since has been a bit of an anticlimax.